Other frameworks have cloned the features of Rails, but in this presentation from RailsConf, its creator, David Heinemeier Hansson, says the Rails philosophy of convention over configuration and abstracting users from making choices continues to give its developer community a competitive advantage. From IT Conversations. Hi, and welcome to IT Conversations. This is Phil Wendley, the executive producer. Today, I'm excited to bring you a presentation from RailsConf.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. The Conversations Network is once again looking for website editors. If you'd like to put in a few hours each month writing descriptions for our programs and earn a few dollars in the process, just go to conversationsnetwork.org/editor. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media.
And now, here's our presentation from RailsConf.
All right. So we're going to talk about something awesome tonight. We're going to talk about the great surplus. And last year, I briefly talked about the notion that maybe maybe the party's kind of a little bit over. We've done the party thing, but nah, screw that. Let's have another party. I think because there's actually plenty of reason to still be partying. And I think we need to recognize that despite the fact that I've worked on Rails now for 5 years. The five-year plan is progressing very nicely for our party. And I think it's worth taking some time to reflect on what has worked in that five-year plan, where we are, and so forth. And I'm trying to frame that under the notion of the great surplus. So to me, the great surplus is that despite the fact that we've been in existence for some 4 years or so, we still hold a very large surplus of productivity over most mainstream languages. And despite the fact that this is a hall full of people doing Ruby on Rails, we're tiny. Ruby on Rails, even though it might not seem like it, is still a tiny, tiny sliver in the grand scheme of things. The mainstream environments out there are still dominating the industry, and I think that's an interesting point. I think it's interesting to look at why do we have this surplus, how is it that we're currently maintaining it, and how are we spending it. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this surplus tonight. And I think the interesting thing about the surplus too is it's really not that unique. It's not like Ruby on Rails is the only environment out there who has a surplus over the mainstream environments. And it's nothing new either. There's been plenty of environments long before Ruby on Rails who's generally done a whole lot better than the mainstream. But for some reason or another, at least in this niche that we're currently inhabiting in the web world, there is something missing. There's something that, despite the fact that lots of environments pose a surplus over the mainstream, they don't have whatever that is that makes it go green. For some reason or another, we have a market. We have a market where the surplus we're generating is something we can sell. And that's actually fairly unique, I think, to have a market for the surplus we're generating that we can turn that surplus into more than just rah-rah for our own technically points. It's actually something we can use and something we can sell. And I think that was something Gerald Spolsky touched on this morning. What is it that actually makes Rails a blue chip in this tiny niche of the industry? I'm going to try to kind of look at some of these things. And as I was talking about before, even though we might be a blue chip in the small space, we're still a tiny, tiny slice of the overall market for people addressing the same problems as we are. Anyway, so I'm going to look at how we got this surplus, how it is that we're outperforming the market, outperforming the industry on productivity in a lot of senses. And I think that this is, a lot of this stuff is stuff we kind of know. but haven't made explicit. And something I'm constantly reminded of too is that not everybody has been around in the Rails world for the past 5 years. We keep getting new people all the time, and I think it's important that we continuously share our beliefs and our values along the way with just those productivity gains that we're producing. It is more than just being able to make a faster website. And I think we need to be able to reiterate these points over and over as more people join our community. So I've tried to sum this up in 4 or 5 points. What it is that made Ruby on Rails special, what I think worked, besides the obvious things. So I think one point I keep coming back to over and over again when I talk about Ruby on Rails is that we confessed commonality. We confessed the fact that we're not as special as we like to believe. We confess that we're not the only ones trying to climb the same mountain. And I think this is a really important point because it's somewhat counterintuitive, I think, for a lot of developers to think that they're not that special. I think it's counterintuitive for humans in general to think they're not that special. But when they do think that they're special, when they do think that they're the only ones climbing that mountain, they kind of get these assumptions that they need very unique and special tools that will only work for them. And I think that's a really bad way to approach getting greater productivity, because I think what really makes this special and makes it work is all the points where we recognize that we're exactly the same. And this goes for pretty much every single layer of what it is that we're doing. The different industries people are in, we're not all from the same cloth here. There's people who's doing e-commerce stuff, travel stuff, productivity stuff, all kinds of different things, all kinds of different industries, but the things that makes those industries different are really not that relevant to the kind of stuff that we're producing. Even within the same industries, companies, competitors often think that they're oh so special, that they're also unique in the kind of tools that they need, and they're really not. I mean, companies are way more alike than they're different when it comes to something as mundane as building a web application. The same goes for the problems we encounter. They're just not that special, and neither are the solutions to these problems. We can be a lot more generic. We can try to abstract a lot more from these solutions. And of course, finally, that means that we as programmers are really not that unique or that special. So I think the conclusion from that, the conclusion from the fact that we're not so unique and special as we'd like to believe, is that the fact that the flexibility we think we want, we really don't. So I think the second part is that we ceded flexibility. We realized early on that flexibility is not free. Flexibility is a trade-off from something else. And that's, again, one of those things that's hard to kind of give up. Instinctively, you're going to have this notion that you want as much flexibility as you possibly can get. How can that be bad? How can having more flexibility not be a good thing? Well, I tried to sum this up as people like choices a lot better than actually having to choose. And I think this is touches on an interesting point. There's actually been a lot of research into this, which is the notion of the paradox of choice. We like the idea that we could choose anything, that we could do anything, but when it actually comes to the day where we have to do something, we really don't want all these choices. I just want to know what makes this work today or tomorrow or by my deadline at the very least. We don't want to go through the analytical process of evaluating every single tool for their pros and their cons and then choosing just that special thing it makes that makes it work. And I've seen this, both sides of this, the notion that we really like these choices comes up over and over and over again in the Rails community, but when we actually do have the choices, when something is not standardized, when there's a lot of different things we can pick from, say, internationalization, where we have, I think, 5 great different plugins that each have their pros and cons, What is it that I hear over and over again? Why is this not in the framework? I don't want to evaluate all this stuff. I just want somebody to make the choice for me. But somehow it's hard to make this connection. It's hard to make the connection that even though you think you want the flexibility, you can't really align that with the fact that when you actually need something, you don't want to have to do all that work of making a choice. So in Ruby on Rails, we've solved this in a number of ways. On one level, we've solved it with convention over configuration. The notion that there's so many things that we could make choices about when we're making a web application that just doesn't matter. Make the choice once, for crying out loud, and let's move on. Stuff like, what's the primary key in your database called? Are we going to pluralize the tables? It's stuff we all take for granted now, but it didn't used to be like that. It used to be like that you have to make all these choices over and over and over again. Because programmers thought that this flexibility was what everybody wanted. But when we actually gave people the conventions that you could just follow these simple rules and you'd get all these choices made for you, people flocked to it. And I think this is kind of established now. This is established as an idea that's a good idea. A lot of other people are kind of picking that up as a good idea. One of the things that's not quite as established is the notion of preferential treatment. Or not even preferential treatment, more like just a preferred choice. So Ruby on Rails is really a collection of different frameworks and different choices. So for the template language, the default choice is ERB or Builder. The default choice for your ORM is Active Record or Active Resource. And the default choice for the JavaScript stuff is Prototype and Scriptaculous. The fact that these default choices exist says nothing about the fact that there can be more choices too. In fact, I believe that Rails now has more than 20 different template languages that could be plugged in. But most of the time, when people start a new project and they don't have a specific preference for something outside, they don't want to go through the analytical process of evaluating all 20 template languages, they really prefer just the fact that there is a default choice. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's actually a great thing that we just give people the opportunity to pick their choices when they care. Sometimes people will care a lot about their template language. They'll, for example, just be all programmers on the team, and they'll think that ERB is an ugly mix of HTML and Ruby code. Fine, then they pick something else. Sometimes Active Record is not exactly what they need to do. They need to do some more legacy stuff, and they'll pick something else. That's great. The point here is that we offer everything right now as one coherent package. Instead of putting the burden on the programmers saying, make all these choices, we're saying, here's our choices. Pick the ones you don't like and change them. I think one of the higher points or higher level points is the fact that we decided that tech matters. When I started doing Ruby on Rails, and even since then, some of the pushback that I got from claiming that, hey, I'm a more happy programmer now. I get more done than I was getting done in the mainstream environments. I got a lot of pushback from guys like these. People sit around a board and have meetings to decide what we're going to do in the next quarter. People will think that programming doesn't matter. People will think that tech doesn't matter. And that the productivity gains you can get out of that really are inconsequential compared to the next master plan for something. And I think that that's really a strong point. We got tech back on the table as something that mattered. That the mainstream languages were kind of falling into, or the mainstream platforms were kind of falling into this notion, well, this is it. We're going to incrementally kind of improve a little bit from here, but basically this is it. Like all the productivity gains are going to be had from other parts. And this rested on actually a sound notion that great people rarely fail because of poor technology, which is true. It's just such a low bar. Is really all you want is just not to fail? Come on. I mean, you can raise your game just a little bit, but I think this is a reflection of how dismal our industry is if your main success criteria is just not to fail. That's pretty pathetic. And I think that putting back tech on the table is saying that great people can do a lot more than not fail. They can do great things, and they can do them fast. And caring about these great people and caring about people in general, I think it's the final point. We said programmers matter too. Tech matters, but programmers matters at least as much. And of course we got all of this from Matt's and this wonderful mission statement that I think this was one of the things that really sealed the deal for me on Ruby. Reading this in an interview from Matt saying, Ruby is designed to make programmers happy. What an awesome statement. What an awesome description and goal to have for something like a programming language. So I think this is all great. I think there's so much cause for celebration in the Ruby and the Rails community in general, that we have things that are working and we have people who are willing to buy what we're producing, that we have some momentum, that we have a lot of things going on, a lot of things pushing for us. But I got to tell you though, there's some bad news to this. And the bad news is the surplus won't last forever. This is not a permanent state of affair. There is no way that we can maintain out-market productivity gains and continue to have growing market share. This is not how the universe is going to function or allow this to function. So the surplus time is limited. And I think the reason it's limited is that one of three things is going to happen. Either the mainstream languages are going to copy Rails enough that there's not going to be any Rails advantage. There's not going to be any Rails surplus. I'm not so confident that's going to happen anytime soon. People have been trying this, and I think a lot of the mainstream languages have been trying this for a long time. It was, I think, 3 years ago that somebody in the Java camps announced victory because they had cloned scaffolding. Now this was going to surely be the end of Rails because now they had the crown jewel. Okay. That didn't really happen, did it? Did any of you guys switch back to Java because you saw that you can now do scaffolding in Java? No? No, I didn't think so. So I don't have a whole lot of confidence in that happening anytime soon. It might. It might. It's definitely one of those points out there of something that could happen. What I think is a lot more likely is that another dramatic alternative is going to arrive. Somebody is going to come up with something that's just a whole lot better than we're fooling around with right now. A new paradigm, a new approach, a new something. The thing about this thing is that once the snowball is rolling, 5% is not going to do it. You can't out-rails Rails with 5% improvement. You can't do it with 10% improvement. It has to be a substantial, massive improvement in the same sense that the Rails snowball got rolling. We didn't get rolling because we were 5% more efficient than the mainstream environments. We got rolling because we're a lot more efficient than mainstream environments. So I think that this is probably one of the most likely alternatives, that over some period of time, somebody's going to come out with something that's just a whole lot better. And we're going to think, damn, the train has left the station. We're not going to, this thing is not going to ride any further. Or finally, which could be fun, is that Rails becomes the mainstream. And you lose your surplus just by the fact that everybody else is doing it too. Which is cool to think about. It's cool to think about that we can kind of get people going on this. But on the other hand, if you're working with this, that's your part of your competitive advantage is gone. Which is kind of why I've always had this ambivalent relationship with the spread of Rails, with the adoption of Rails. That if everybody actually used this, would that be cool? Would that be a good thing? I think we've been questioning this for some time, but it's in some ways it's not really up to us. But it is something that makes me think every now and again that having that whole question mark still linger for 5 years of, but does it scale? Is that really such a bad thing? Like, if there's some people out there who doesn't think it scales, so what? It means we're actually going to retain that surplus, that competitive advantage even longer, because it means they won't switch. They'll stay in their Java, PHP, C# world, and all the better, right? If you're actually a company competing with other companies, you want them to use crappy tools. Because it means that you have an edge. Having an edge in business, in something like productivity, is usually a pretty good thing. But it's also a conflict, because on the other hand, we feel good about this. We feel good about rescuing people from these nasty environments that they've been stuck in for so long. So in some ways, it's a matchup between your altruism or egotism and your sense of business. In any case, I think one of these three things is going to happen. I do not think the surplus can last forever. And then we can say, like Private Hudson, well, it's game over, man! It's game over! What the fuck are we gonna do now? Well, I think we can do one of two things. We can either go bender on it all and spend our surplus on hookers, fur coats, and golden rings. Yeah! Let's just blow that surplus right now! Which basically means going along with business as usual. Because that is what business as usual is. It is blowing the surplus at every single opportunity that you have. Which also is kind of depressing, because that's the dismal industry average. That is really not such an appealing vision for the world, I think. It means running at 110% all the time. It means trying to get the most billable hours you can, trying to finish that project as soon as you can, trying to push out as many features as you humanly feel possible. I don't think that's a good state to be in, because I think it needs to, or it comes with this fire territory. Every day is another fire. Every day there's something that needs to get done, preferably right now. Is this urgency that's really part of business as usual, part of running with no surplus? And I think it comes with something else too. When you're running at 110% all the time, when you're fighting fires all the time, you get lost in the mechanics. You get your head so far down that you really can't see what else is going on, which is, I think, what is happening to most businesses out there. Why it is that we're able to maintain this surplus for so long? Because people just don't care. They don't see. They don't discover. When you're running at 110% fires all the time, you don't have time to pay attention to anything else. So of course you're just going to let this slide until it's going to be so big that you can't ignore it. So being lost in the mechanics, being running at 110% means a very predictable recipe of being fatigued, disinterested, passionless. And I think that's kind of just the inevitable thing that happens when you don't have that buffer, when you don't have that surplus. And it can definitely happen to rail shops too. I think it's at least as likely to happen. Because just because you do something more efficiently doesn't mean you'll have the human power to take something out of that and not just try to focus it all to the bottom line. And I think that the result of that, the conclusion is that it's just a job. That is the most depressing statement I hear so often. I just have a job. Who wants to just have a job? You're spending 8, 10, 12 hours a day on something that you describe as just having a job. That is just so utterly depressing. And I really hope that we're not going to go bender on this surplus. That we're not going to end up with people who just work at another rail shop thinking this is just a job. I'm just here to direct that surplus to the bottom line. I think that there's a much better way. I think that we can be much, much wiser about the unique time, limited time, that we have right now to do something better with the surplus. And I think that it's going Dubai. I think Dubai is incredibly interesting as a parallel or as a mirror of how to spend a surplus. There are so many nations around the globe right now who are making billions on oil. And most of them are spending them on hookers, fur coats, and golden rings. And what's going to happen when that oil runs out? They're going to have to give up the hookers, return the fur coat, and hawk the golden rings. Everything is going to go right back to square one. Well, Dubai is not going to have it end up like that if they can help it. They're actually trying to take some of that golden black gold and invest it into something more durable than just filling the coffers of some dictator somewhere. Well, they're doing that too, but at least some of it is going to build nice, shiny towers. And I think that that's actually a great parallel for what we should be doing, what we should be spending that surplus on. We should be spending it on something that's going to last. Outside profits are not going to last. When the surplus stops, the outside profits will stop too, and you're going to end up just at square one. Now, I think that there's one thing we can do, one thing and one place we can invest in that's going to outlast even rails. And I think that investment is you. Investing in yourself, investing in becoming a better mensch, is going to be the only lasting way you can maintain surplus. Regardless of what happens with rails, regardless of what happens with technology, if you better yourself as a programmer, as a human being, that's going to last until the next technology too. And the unique time we have is that with this surplus, you should have that extra time, that extra profit, that extra energy to actually invest while it lasts. Because we're talking all about how much faster is rails to develop this, that, and the other thing. And really, I don't care what that number is. Maybe it's 20% for you, maybe it's 50%, maybe it's 10 times. I don't really care. I'm not going to do any studies on that. Very few people are, because it's so hard to compare these things. Well, there's another area of productivity that people have actually been studying for a very, very long time, and that's programmers. And what they found is that some programmers are 10 times better than the average. And that's really something that lasts. If you can, as a programmer, as a human, outperform somebody else in a similar technology with a similar set of tools, 1 to 10, you're in pretty damn good shape. And I think people look at this number and, yeah, they nod their heads. Yeah, there's some people who are really rock stars out there. There's some people who are really superstars, and they can really, they can pull it off, right? But that's those other people. That's not me. And I think that's just such a mistaken notion that people are born rock star programmers. Bullcrap. Nobody's born a rock star programmer. You learn everything. And the surplus, the time you can spend now, is put it into yourself to learn how to become that rock star programmer. Because whatever you invest now to do that, as I said, is going to outlast pretty much everything else. And I'm going to talk about some of the techniques that I try to use, that I think you could use too, to invest in yourself, to become a 10x programmer, to take those profits that you have and turn them into something that's going to last even after the oil runs out. The first one is to recharge tangentially, or something. That's my Danish pronunciation of that word. I had to look it up too. And this recharging, doing something else than just sitting in front of the computer all day, I think is really critically important. Being a programmer and programming for a lot of hours is great. It's going to trigger some very specific parts of your brain, but there's plenty of other parts of your brain that are not really going to be engaged just by sitting in front of the screen all day. So I'm going to just take some examples from what some of the people at 37 Signals are doing and that we're trying to encourage people of doing. We have a guy who got into whittling. This is actually a spoon he made. This is James Buck. Some of you might know him, the author of Capistrano and a big contributor to Ruby on Rails. He got into whittling, and he's making these amazing things in his spare time as a way of engaging something else than just sitting in front of his computer and making open source software. And I think this is really cool. Another person for our team got into Playing the banjo, playing music is engaging different parts of your brain than just programming. And that's really the key about all of these things, is to try to bring all levels up, because they don't work in isolation. It's kind of like if you're working out. If you're trying to train just one muscle, you can't just focus on that one muscle. The whole structure, your whole body, your whole skeleton kind of has to fit together. And I think the best programmers are the kind of programmers who do something else than just program. Finally, we have another guy who's learning how to fly a plane. We're trying to sponsor that at 37 Signals too, and we're trying to sponsor all of these things. Take some of those outsized profits, some of that surplus we're generating by using Ruby and Rails, and investing it in the people that we have. And I think this is happening way too little. Whenever I hear about people or companies investing in their people, it's usually about, yeah, we're going to give our employees 20% off to do more programming. Okay. That helps. That's a good start. But I think forcing people out of their editor, good thing. Engaging those other parts of the brain, bringing the whole system up, that's what truly takes people to the next level. Now, speaking of the next level, I think you should sleep more. I keep hearing about people operating on 5-6 hours of sleep and thinking to myself, how does that work? Whenever I get 5 or 6 hours of sleep, it's very apparent to me that I'm not operating at peak performance. And that seems like just such a waste. And it's such a weird thing, because somehow we got this elevated not sleeping to Superman status. This is what the real hardcore people do. They sit up all night and they're programmed through the night and they can take it. Well, I don't think so. I think you can get a little bit more performance out of a single day. Sure, if you're willing to shoot off the next day. How many projects are dependent on what happens on just one day? Not very many. But again and again, we choose to celebrate these superhuman approaches to working. And I think that's really unhelpful. I mean, not the least, like, look at how silly that guy looks. A cape doesn't fit very many people. You really need a special structure for that. It hardly looks good on that guy. Imagine you? No. So, drop the cape crap. Drop trying to be a Superman by working fantastic hours. And start sleeping more and realizing what your peak performance is. Try using that instead. Because that's something that's sustainable. It's something that's sustainable, getting enough sleep, operating your peak performance every day. I'd much, much rather have 4 good hours in a day where I'm really operating my peak performance than getting 10 hours where I'm, meh. It's those 10 hours where you're going to fuck everything up, where you need the other 4 hours to clean it up. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. Now, another thing I've started to notice for myself is that keeping up with everything that's going on, that takes a lot of time. And somehow I got that time by stopping to read paper. And I think that's really a shame. I think you can get a certain kind of knowledge, a certain kind of improvement in what you're doing by reading a ton of blogs. And I read a ton of blogs, and I read a ton of sites, and I check Reddit every day. But it's very current affairs. It's very current events. And sometimes when I think back of what did I actually learn over the past month of reading RSS feeds, I have a hard time coming up with anything. Which is really not a very good score for something I can spend hours on every day. Where is the return on that investment? So I think that try cutting down on your RSS feed. Try cutting down on the amount of crap you read about current affairs, about current things that's going on in the development environment, because most of this stuff doesn't matter. Most of the stuff you're not going to remember next week. It's going to be a pretty poor investment. So it sounds silly. I'm at a Riley conference and I'm advocating reading books, but I really mean that. And it's not just because you should read the book with my name on, because I actually don't think you should. This is not part of that. This is not about reading books about implementations, about current things, about frameworks. It's reading books that are going to last, where the impact you get out of those things are going to stick around. So one author I've consistently consulted for knowledge that's going to stick around is Gerald M. Weinberger. And I think he's probably one of my favorite authors. This is a great book for anybody who's doing consulting. It's called The Secrets of Consulting. And it's not really about tech very much at all. It's about humans. And it's about learning to interact with those. Speaking about humans, speaking about yourself and how you're performing on the job, Chad Fowler wrote actually a great book a while back on what you can do in similar vein of what I'm talking about to improve yourself, to improve yourself of getting out of just whatever rot you're in right now, and by incident saving your job from being shipped to India. Finally, reading about tech is not necessarily bad if it's at a level that's going to last. Ken Beck, who's going to keynote tomorrow, has written a ton of wonderful books. He has a new one out called Implementation Patterns, which I'm reading right now, and I just love it. There's nobody really like Ken who has the analytical depth to analyze the things that we do every single day and put them into a light, a way that you hadn't thought about before. On that note, I think just expanding your own skills as a consultant, expanding your own skills as a developer, expanding your skills as somebody who's going to stick around in your company, those are definitely all important things. But I think we can go even further than that. I think we can try to aspire to more. Under this notion of go Renaissance, Da Vinci was a great Renaissance man because he knew more than one thing. And this is kind of similar to the notion that you should have hobbies outside of just writing code. You should also try to learn more about other professions that interact with what it is you're doing. As Joe was talking about this morning, this notion of programmers, for example, they don't get the aesthetics. They don't get the marketing part. They think it's all bullcrap. And I think that the reason that they don't get it is because they don't want to get it. But they'd be so much better off if they did, if they understood what it is that makes the iPod succeed and the Zoom fail. They'd be much better programmers. They'd be much better positioned to kind of spot trends from fads and so on. So I think programmers in general should try to learn something about business. This is a great book called The Innovator's Dilemma that kind of describes how major shifts in businesses occur. It's really an eye-opening thing for me to read. And it was something, it didn't really relate directly to what I was going to do on my next project, the next piece of code I was going to write, but it really put my mind in a way that I understood some larger patterns of what was going on around me. And there's no programmer out here who makes a living programming who's not affected by business. And I think too many programmers, they kind of just write it off. Well, that's what some other people are going to do. I'm just going to focus on my one thing. And I think you can be so much more valuable, not just to the business you're working in, but to yourself, to your understanding of the world, if you try to just broaden your perspective a little bit, bring in other fields, go Renaissance in some of these things. So business is the one obvious other factor that I think programmers should really educate themselves in. Design is another obvious one. Just like programmers have this ignorant relationship with marketing and business, a lot of programmers have a very ignorant relationship with design. They don't really appreciate it as more as painting lipstick on a pig. They don't appreciate it in the sense that this is actually something that has impact on what it is that they do. This is just what those those designers work on in Photoshop, and they make it all pretty and round. It doesn't really have any impact on what I'm doing. I think it has a huge impact. I think appreciating the sign leads to such a better relationship within a team. When you know that the designer is asking you to change something that you did because of things that you can realize, things that you can spot, oh yeah, that's actually better because this, that, and the other thing, it's going to be such a more pleasurable experience to work in that environment. And I think all of these things, trying to get a better understanding of business, trying to get a better understanding of design, all boils down to one thing, which is to get a better understanding of value. So I think the most important skill, actually, that a programmer can have is the ability to recognize whether something is valuable or not. So many programmers out there have this notion, or is lacking this notion, of determining whether what they're working on is valuable enough, or if it's even more valuable than they think. So we often get into this scenario that we've been working on something for days because we've been trying to polish this one thing and it just doesn't matter. It's just not valuable enough to spend 3 days on. Being able to distinguish those things, I think, is a huge part of what makes the 10 times more productive programmer. Because the 10 times more productive programmer, he writes the same amount of code. He doesn't write 10 times as many lines of code. He just writes 10 times as valuable lines of code. That the amount of programming he puts in is the stuff that matters. And I think the only way to find out and figure out the stuff that matters is by knowing more than that technical domain. It's by knowing what is this going to do to our users, what is this going to do to our business, is this going to drive upgrades, is this going to drive further sales, is this seam on the back of the iPhone, is that really what matters? Well, apparently it's part of what matters. Most programmers wouldn't have recognized that at all. They would just have said, oh, of course the users need an interchangeable battery, and put that right in, and failed as a result of that. So, a corollary to recognizing value and being able to distinguish between these things is the notion of programming less. I think most of the guys we have here program way too much. I've actually not written a single line of programming while I've been here at the entire conference. And I think that's a good thing. I think that, in general, we write way too much programming instead of just writing the right things. And getting to that point is hard. It's not immediately obvious when you're just not working, when you're just goofing off, and when you're choosing to work on just the stuff that matters. But I think the only way you can find out is by trying, is by forcefully just trying to write less lines of code. So if you can somehow figure out that you're currently writing, I don't know, 500 lines of code currently a day, try writing 300. Putting a cap on the amount of work you can put into something really crystallizes the concept of value. When I was originally working on Basecamp, I had 10 hours per week to work on developing Basecamp. That experience, that constraint, is probably the single most important thing in my programming career. It is the single most important thing in the terms of recognizing those constraints and developing a sense of value. When you only have 10 hours per week to work on something, it's impossible not to work on the valuable bits, because it's so painfully obvious if you're not working on the valuable bits. You can spend 10 hours very, very easily on stuff that doesn't matter, and then you got nothing done for that week. So this kind of goes back into the whole notion of cutting down on the resources you allow yourself to put into programming. Not running at 110%, trying to recharge with doing stuff outside of sitting in front of the computer, that cuts down on the amount of time you have available. Trying to learn other things, spending active time on bettering yourself, that's going to cut down on the amount of time you have to sit in front of a computer. Forcefully just thinking, I'm going to program less. It's going to put a very specific time box on what you're doing. I think this is a huge part of what makes XP work, what made most of these agile mythologies work, was that they put time boxes on things. And I think you can do well by putting time boxes on your own
programming life.
Part of that, or related to that, is the notion that when you were just working on the same project over and over again for a long period of time, for example, I've been working on Basecamp for 5 years, it's hard to keep that up. It's hard to keep that discipline. So this is why I think sometimes you just need to start from scratch. If you work in a company where you guys just have one main product, you have to try something else. You have to every now and again try a blank sheet of paper. Maybe that's a new feature that could be spin out into a new application. Maybe it's just something internally you need. Maybe it's just some of that 20% time you're going to have assigned to stealthy programming, but you can spend it on something fresh. I think this is, I learned the most about Rails whenever I start a new project. Whenever you see a spike in commits with my name on, it's because I start a new project. It's because I learn so much more whenever I start from fresh than I do just going along in whatever it is that I'm doing. For better or worse, I'm not learning that much new programming Basecamp. I learned so much new programming Highrise because it was a fresh sheet of paper. It kind of got me out of that rut. It kind of got me out of being lost in the mechanics. It got me a chance to try some of these things I've been learning all over again. I think one of the killer things on programmer improvement is this whole notion of legacy. Maintaining the same application years after years after years is just a perfect recipe for wearing people down. Because there's only so much new you can try when you're working on the same thing year in and year out. So start something from scratch. Even if it's not related to the product you're doing, start an open source thing from scratch. Second, as was touched on just in the Ruby Heroes just before, start sharing. You learn so much by sharing. I've learned more about programming from sharing the Rails framework than pretty much anywhere else. You simply cannot overstate the effect that you get personally from sharing with somebody else. Giving a talk, writing a blog post, sharing a piece of code, I gotta admit, it's really not about you, it's about me. It's about me in the fact that I get more out of it than I give out. And I think that people don't really realize this. They think sharing is about other people. It's about trying to make somebody else happy, which is why I think there's a lot of companies and business people out there who don't really understand that part. Like, why should we be open sourcing this again? What is the benefit to us? What are we going to get out of this? You're going to get better people, because the amount of knowledge people get from trying to share something is just immense. Related to sharing is this economy we were talking about in the beginning. On the one hand, you want to see the fun of where a lot of people here, and on the other hand, you have this business, hey, I should be keeping this to myself, I should be keeping this as an advantage, but I think you do get so much more out of spreading the message. Not just sharing, but trying to convince other people, trying to go through all of the arguments, because whenever I was trying to convince somebody of something, I learned what it was about that thing that made it click for me. When you have to articulate why you like something, you understand so much better your own passions, what it is that makes you interested in stuff. And finding that out is just such a great path for figuring out where you should be spending your time. When you know what makes yourself tick, it's just a very, very powerful key. And I'm going to end with a quote of why we're doing all this, why we're doing the betterment of ourselves, why we're trying to invest in ourselves for the long term. I got this wonderful metaphor from Alistair Cockburn a while back of viewing software development as a cooperative game. And he's saying the purpose of playing this game well is to be able to get the best position on the next game. Software development is very rarely about this project, about what you're doing this week. It's about setting up that there's going to be a week after that. Most of us are not just going to work on the one project. We're going to work on hundreds of projects. So the amount that you can invest right now to kind of set yourself up in a better spot for all the games that's coming after this game, is worth trading up a lot for the current game. And usually it doesn't even work like that. Usually spending time on yourself, bettering yourself, doesn't take anything away from the daily grind. Because most people don't work the daily grind anyway. Most programmers waste most of their time most days that they're working. So there's a lot of slack just available for extraction. And at 37 Signals, we've been trying a new thing recently, which is the 4-day work week. And I've been very, very curious with the responses that we've gotten to the 4-day work week. People, that's wild. How can you get anything done? How is that working out? Don't you have this, that, and the other concern? How can you afford it? A 4-day work week is, what, 20% less time? How does 20% less time matter? If you can have programmers who are 10 times as effective as the average guy, if you can work with environments that are 50%, 200%, 1,000% more productive than other environments, how the hell can 20% less time in a chair really be that revolutionary or that special? But somehow, I'm very much seeing that disconnect from people who otherwise recognize all these other parts. From people being really puzzled about how can you make 4 days of work work. And it's very easy. Because for us, at least, it's been, I have not felt any change in the productivity. If anything, I've seen it gone up. Because people are just way more focused in the time that they have. Adding that day at the end of the week to get some of these things up. Out whittling, playing the banjo, learning how to fly a plane, reap so much benefit from the time you actually spend in the chair. And that's where this disconnect, I think, the whole Superman syndrome of trying to work as many hours as possible, it's just a relic. It worked fine when you were swinging in a hammer in some workshop somewhere where the amount of time you put in had a direct consequence on the amount of output you produced. Programming is just not like that. The amount of time you put in has a very weak correlation to the amount of value that comes out. But that just doesn't seem to be an accepted idea, even from people who otherwise recognize the goods of agile, the goods of working in more productive environments and so on. And I think that's a damn shame. So in summary, I think recognize the fact that this surplus is not going to last forever. Don't blow it all on hookers and fur coats. Invest it in yourself. Become better programmers. And that's going to last not for the next framework, but for the next 10 frameworks, for the next 10 paradigms. And you're going to be so much more happy. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a presentation from RailsConf.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. The Conversations Network is once again looking for website editors. If you'd like to put in a few hours each month writing descriptions for our programs and earn a few dollars in the process, just go to conversationsnetwork.org/editor. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Mike Seifried. Our website editor was Sathyesh Chakravarthy. The series producer is George Hawthorne.
This is Phil Windley. I hope you'll join me next time for another exciting program from RailsConf.